All right, before we start the show, boys, Manscaped.com is rocking with us. And there's a few things that I think people should know out there. 96% of partners think bad grooming is a major turnoff, okay? 85% of partners prefer a man who's groomed below the waist. And 91% of men think good grooming is essential to their professional success. Elijah, I know you have your Manscaped package. What are your thoughts on these stats?
I think it's pretty accurate, to be honest. I mean, especially the way social media is and the way things are perceived, I think it's pretty important to keep kind of fresh. And, you know, it's kind of an investment. Why wouldn't you get a product that's going to last for a while, that's going to have you feeling good? And, you know, I think it's pretty important.
Akil Thomas, what's your thoughts on grooming?
I mean, for me, it's just something, you know, you have to do. I think the older you get, the more important it becomes. okay. I know, you know, when I was younger, I didn't care about my outfit. I didn't care about wearing deodorant and all that stuff. But as I get older, I've started to care about it more. So I'm really excited to get this product and try it out. And you see it everywhere. You see it on YouTube ads and, you know, ads everywhere. And, you know, I really want to try this thing out and see if it really does, you know, what everyone says it does. And looks like they got a good brand going there as well. So, you know, I think grooming's important. And, you know, if you have a significant other, it's, you know, only what you should do.
All right. So let's break it down to everybody. Get 20% off and free shipping with the promo code SOUL, S-O-U-L, at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use the promo code SOUL. Their perfect package 3.0 comes with the new and improved lawnmower, waterproof, cordless body trimmer, performance boxer briefs. And I got to tell you guys, I'm wearing it right now. I love these boxer briefs. It's a great little package for the boys down below. So when you're thinking about hockey, think about manscaped.com. And with that being said, let's start the show.
Nice. Soul on ice. I'ma put my soul on ice. Nice.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, or good night. Thank you for joining us whenever or wherever you are listening. You are now rocking with the best. Shout out to Brother B holding us down on all of our social media platforms. Make sure you link up with us by searching Soul on Ice, the podcast. We now have a Reddit community and a Spotify playlist where you can see all the top 5 hype songs our guests have picked. Shout out to our bro C-Dub for setting that up for us. Today is a very special show because it's dedicated to Hockey Fights Cancer Month, which is going on as we speak. Just some quick facts about this deadly disease. In 2020, an estimated 1,806,590 new cases of cancer will be diagnosed in the United States, and 606,520 people will die from it. Nearly 1 in 2 Canadians will be diagnosed with cancer in their lifetime. Colorectal cancer also disproportionately affects the Black community, where the rates are the highest of all racial ethnic groups. Today, we are going to speak to a few people who have been affected by this deadly disease. Owen Brady is a young hockey player who has fought the good fight battling cancer, and our feature interview is with the living legendary broadcaster and former player, coach, and cancer survivor, Eddie Olczyk. But first, let me introduce to you the Get Busy Boys. Double Trouble is in the house, Akil Thomas and Elijah Roberts. What's good, boys?
Not too much. I'm actually in Brampton right now. I just helped my family move, but things are going good and just kind of chilling right now.
Same for me, just chilling. Still in Germany. Road trip tomorrow. We're going to Munich and Mannheim. So, like, 2 top teams in our league. Pretty excited. And apparently, we're going to play in a pretty sick barn. So, I'm excited for that, too.
All right. Well, let's get on the score sheet, maybe.
Yeah, hopefully, because this weekend I went donuts again. But I did have a lot of hit the crossbar in the slot. So at least I'm getting chances, but definitely a donut guy right now.
All right, well, we'll get that monkey off the back. Let's get busy, boys. Joining us is a former captain of the Whitby Wildcats minor midget team. His name is Owen Brady. Thanks for joining us, Owen. How are you doing?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Good. Thanks for joining, man, for sure.
Yeah, Owen, me and you don't really know each other, but, you know, I was on Twitter one day and scrolling, and I saw your story, and I thought it was pretty inspirational, and just wanted you to share the story with the people here.
Yeah, so kind of about 2 years ago, actually, I was on my Snapchat today, and I saw two years ago today was, like, the final game I played with my Whippy team. It was in Quinte. I actually scored on the power play, I remember. And then a few days later, I went to Sick Kids after I went to the walk-in clinic. I got diagnosed for osteosarcoma. It was in my left shin. And then that's kind of how it all started. And I kind of had to step away from hockey and just kind of had to deal with that.
How long did you step away for?
Quite a while. So probably about, I had a surgery in December 2018. And then I had my chemo for 6 months, and then the surgery kind of had a long rehab. And then I finally got to play my first game in this year in August at the Carne Valley hockey group tournament there. So that's where I first played. So it was about year and a half and a bit or something like that.
So when you first got diagnosed, what were the symptoms? What drove you and your family to have to go to the walk-in clinic?
I had a tumor that was noticeably there on my left shin. It didn't hurt. I could play. I was playing with it for quite a bit. It didn't hurt. I didn't have any symptoms, but I wanted to get it checked out. And then I got an x-ray at the walk-in clinic, and they said it was osteosarcoma, which was like kind of weird. And then the next morning we went to Sick Kids to kind of make it official. But I didn't have any symptoms or anything that was impairing my ability to play the game.
When you're diagnosed, they told you you'd never play again?
Yeah, when we met with the surgeon for the first time, I asked him, I was like, first thing came to my mind, I was, we think I'll be able to play hockey again? He's like, he didn't really have a complete answer, but he was pretty confident on no, and just because how invasive the surgery was going to be, and he said no, but and that was pretty upsetting.
So you get this news, you go through this treatment. Is hockey still on your mind? What motivated you to want to, you know, make a comeback and play the game?
When I had to step away from it for so long, it just made me realize how much I loved it. You know, it was such a big part of my life, and like not having it and not doing it for such a long time just made me want to do it even more. I want to pursue my dreams even more. And it's been driving me to this day.
So guys, usually, you know, notice when, you know, they feel a difference when they haven't been on the ice in like, you know, a week or something like that. You're off the ice for, you know, way longer than a week. How did it feel to get back on the ice and, you know, start skating again?
I didn't really forget it. I didn't really forget how to do it. It's kind of like riding a bike. You don't forget how to do it, but it was different. My leg was obviously really weak, and both my legs were, because I had surgery on both legs. I remember the first time I went out, it was at Campus Ice Center in Oshawa. I went out with my physio and Paul Ranger. We rented the ice, and I got a couple of my friends, and I skated for the first time. It was cool to have everybody out there, but also it was a bit emotional and sad, because it realized how far away I was to where I was before so shortly ago. So, yeah.
And what about now? How are you feeling now? How has the rehab been for you? And, you know, where are you at? Are you back at 100%?
I think I'm pretty close to it. I mean, there's only so much you can do with doing the practicing and doing all the skills and drills and going with a skating coach. Like, you need the games to get back in game shape, being regular with playing in a game, you know, making those game time decisions and stuff like that. So the thing I'm missing right now in my rehab, my journey, is just playing games, getting those first 20 games under my belt to get me back on.
Your support system through this must have kept you going. Who was kind of there for you, closest to you, that kind of helped you get through this?
I guess kind of all the people I call it my team, you know, my physio. He came over to my house when I couldn't leave the house because I couldn't walk and what have you. And then my trainer, Kristen Smart at Move 365. She's helped me a lot since the beginning. And then my skating coach, Ashley Jones, I started with her in February, and I was with her 3 times a week. And she's probably one of the biggest reasons where I am today, because her skating. And then obviously my friends, my family, and everyone who supported me through the way.
So obviously, you know, we're in a global pandemic right now. There's a lot of uncertainties. People don't really know what, you know, lies ahead of them. But what would you say is next for you? What are the next steps for you?
I guess just kind of waiting till the pandemic is over and waiting till hockey gets going again. But for me, I think my next steps are either playing on a midget team to get me going again, or playing on an OJHL team or Tier 2 Junior A team to maybe get a scholarship in the States and pursue that path, because I've kind of – the OHL door is kind of closed, unfortunately, but I'm not opposed to going the other route.
And for all those young boys and girls out there that might be suffering through some sort of adversity, what would be your message to them? Because – again, for your situation, you know, a doctor told you, yeah, you probably aren't going to play. And obviously you proved them wrong.
I think the biggest advice was just keep doing what you have to do to get better every single day. Take it day by day, one step at a time. If you take one small step at a time and you look back and you come a long way. So don't look at it as the big goal. Just take one step at a time, and over a good amount of time, you'll realize you've come a long way.
I think it's also interesting because the doctor told you might not play. The same thing happened with Willie O'Ree. I'm not sure if you're familiar with who Willie O'Ree is, but when he lost sight in one eye, the doctor told him he'd never play hockey again, and he ended up being the first Black athlete to play in the National Hockey League. So you never know what could happen, my brother, and you just keep fighting. Do you have any plans on, you know, maybe partnering up with any organizations to help spread the awareness of, you know, cancer, and, you know, the NHL has the Hockey Fights Cancer Month. Do you plan on doing anything like that on the ground to help fight this disease?
I haven't really done anything myself. I know a few. I've met up with this little girl who was diagnosed with, I think it was leukemia. And we've been in contact with her, and she started a foundation, or a fundraiser. I can't remember what it's called, but for me personally, I haven't really done anything. I've just, if anyone reaches out to me about their situation, I try to do as much as I can to help and kind of prepare them for what they might experience, and just doing whatever I can to help those people who reach out.
And for those people who want to reach out, maybe hear a little bit more about your story, or any parents who has children that's going through what you went through, how can they find you on social media?
I think the best way to look on Twitter, my Twitter, I think it's Owen Brady 1. There's been a good amount of stories or articles on myself, whether it be the Toronto Star or the Hockey News, as well as the Sportsnet video. It kind of gives a good explanation of what happened. Or reach out on Instagram, Owen Brady with two Y's, and DM me. DMs are open, and I'll be sure to get out and reach back.
All right. Well, Owen, thank you very much for joining us. We got the legendary Eddie Olczyk coming up, so we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to keep rocking. So thanks for joining the Soul on Ice crew.
Thanks, Owen.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Our next guest is what I like to call an OG. We like to call him an OG. He's been around the hockey world for a minute, selected first round back in 1984 to his hometown team, the Chicago Blackhawks. He's played for six teams, 16 seasons, 342 goals, 452 assists. So you know he was dishing out that sweet butter chicken passes. 794 points in just over 1,000 games. He's accomplished a lot in his life. He's represented his country in international play. He's won a Stanley Cup. He's been a coach, a writer, a broadcaster. And I hear he's a pretty good family guy, but we all know who's the better half in the house. Right, Eddie?
Kwame, yes. My wife, the lovely and talented Diana Olczyk of 32 years of my wife. Yeah, she is the brains, the looks. She's everything. And I just say yes. And it's great to be with you guys and hope you're doing well.
I might just say that this man's greatest accomplishment is surviving stage 3 colon cancer to this day. So to all my soul brothers and soul sisters that are listening right now, please welcome Eddie Olczyk. Thank you, Eddie, for joining us.
Thank you, Kwame. Nice to be with you all, and appreciate you having me on. And a little different look for the National Hockey League in the month of November with Hockey Fights Cancer and no hockey going on. But yeah, I'm proud to say that last year I was the ambassador for Hockey Fights Cancer for the National Hockey League, and obviously no National Hockey League right now, but still trying to do stuff for the league and for everybody that's been touched by this horrible disease. So I appreciate you having me on, and it's hard to believe that 3+ years ago, I was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer back on, back in August of 2017. And a lot of things have happened. A lot of things have transpired, have learned a lot. And hopefully we meaning the community of hockey at all levels, but the National Hockey League can make a difference in one person's life, regardless of how cancer has affected them.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a different time we are in right now, but we still have to do our fight for cancer and do our part. But before we start to talk about that, we're also going to talk to your doctor, Mary Mulcahy. She's going to be joining us. We first have to talk about how you got here, your story. You grew up in Chicago. How did you discover hockey, and did your parents put you into it, or did you influence them to let you play?
Yeah, you know, it was back in the day, and you all are way younger than I am. So back in the day, there was no things as emails or text messages or things like that to get a message out. It was go to school, bring home flyers from school, so printed sheets out of, special lunches coming up in a couple of weeks or a field trip, and you'd have to fill out these sheets and bring them back to school. So it just happened that back in, I guess it was the early 70s, I was 6.5 years old, and I brought home a flyer from school one day, and it just said, learn to skate. It didn't say anything about playing hockey. It didn't say anything about anything other than just learning to skate. And my dad never played hockey. My mom was never involved in skating. And that's pretty much my introduction to the game of hockey. And, you know, once I put on a pair of skates for the first time and eventually grabbed a hockey stick a couple of months later, I was hook, line, and sinker. I love sports. I had the opportunity to play baseball as a kid, to play hockey as a kid. Even though in that introduction you gave me, Kwame, you know, I did play 16 years in the NHL and played in the Olympics in 1984 for Team USA as a 17-year-old. Still to this day, the real Ed Olczyk, my father, still thinks I would have been a better baseball player than a hockey player.
Really?
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I did love baseball. But as you guys all know, I mean, hockey becomes, you know, 13 months a year when you're involved in it. So for me, it just was, I was lucky enough to get, had great support at home from my folks, had great support from coaches and a development program in Niles, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago where I grew up, and just fell in love with the game. So for me, it was just, you know, I brought home one of those pieces of paper and the rest is history.
You had a great career, in my opinion, regardless of what your father says. six teams altogether, but none like the 1994 New York Rangers. What was the start of that season like in the dressing room? And, you know, when during the season or postseason did you say to yourself, this group can win it all?
Yeah. Well, we were the best team, you know, going into the start of that 94 season with Mark Messier as our captain, Brian Leetch on the back end and Mike Richter in goal. And then we had a bunch of incredible pieces of the puzzle. And, you know, we didn't get off to a great start that year in 94. You know, we actually got off to a slow start. And I think we were 500 after the first maybe 12 or 13 games of the regular season. And then once we found our game, we just became really unstoppable. And, you know, most players play the game at the highest level to obviously, you know, have a way of life and to make money and what have you. But I think the majority of the players, you know, really want that opportunity to have a chance to win a Stanley Cup. And, you know, I'd played 10 years in the league and had got to the conference finals one time. And that happened to be in my rookie year with the Chicago Blackhawks in the playoffs of 85. And we lost to the Edmonton Oilers in six games, but to have been a very small part of a team in New York and have the pressure of not winning a Stanley Cup since 1940 was pretty special, because the pressure was on. Everybody expected us with the talent that we had and the trades that were made and the off-season signings we made, is that we were the team to beat. And we played like it. We went stretches where we didn't lose a game for maybe, I think, 16 or 17. I mean, back then we had ties in the NHL. But we were, you know, we felt like we were the best team and had our hands cut out. You know, our hands were full come playoff time when we took on New Jersey in the conference finals and won in seven games in double overtime, and then eventually beat the Vancouver Canucks in seven games. So the ultimate prize, the ultimate dream is to win a Stanley Cup. And I was able to do that in 94, and especially to win it in a city like New York, where they hadn't seen a Stanley Cup in 54 years, was pretty darn special. And to this day, I sit in my office, or I sit down here in my mini office in the basement, and not see things that don't remind me of winning, because you think you know how hard it is to win until you actually attain it. And we were able to do that, and a great feeling to have won a Stanley Cup and get my name on a Stanley Cup, and something that you can't say a lot of things are forever. But my name on the Stanley Cup and our Ranger team in 94, that is forever.
You talked about Jersey, beating Jersey in seven. You talked about Mark Messier in that series, that game seven. Yeah. Mark Messier guaranteed a win. Not only did you guys win, he scored a hat trick. Was he just lights out during that playoff? And from a teammate's perspective, were you like, hey man, what are you doing talking about, we gonna win? Don't guarantee nothing, man. Don't jinx us. Is that the atmosphere?
No, it was actually, you know what, we will control on what is going to take place regardless of the outcome. And I think that's why, you know, Mess had so much confidence to be able to say, hey, you know what, yeah, we may be down in the series against the New Jersey Devils, but we're going to find a way to win this game six and push us on to game seven, and then eventually game win.
Six, that's right. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. And then eventually win the Stanley Cup in the next round. So, I mean, when you have leadership like that and you have veteran guys that have been through it and been around it, I mean, I could go on and on. I mean, you know, guys like Craig McTavish and Adam Graves and Sergei Zubov, I mean, Kevin Lowe, you can go on and on and on. I mean, we had everything. We had great goaltending. We had great defense. We had tough guys like Joey Kosher and Nick Kyprios. You know, I mean, we had on and on. I mean, we had just a little bit of everything. But, you know, there was a great belief and an understanding is that there had to be great commitment. I don't care what walk of life you're in. If you're not committed to the cause, you know, not really sure of what the outcome is going to be. So there was a lot of trust. There was a lot of belief, and but that was pretty surreal to be a part of that. It was kind of like Joe Namath, like back in the day in the National Football League, where it became headlines when Mess guaranteed that we were going to win that game, and he stepped up and had a hat trick in that game, as you mentioned, and then eventually win the Stanley Cup a couple of weeks later.
Mm.
Being around Messier must have been pretty cool. I mean, a player of that talent, and when you were done coaching, you got the chance, or done playing, you got the chance to go coach in Pittsburgh. You coached Crosby. What was he like, and did you see any similarities or differences between him and Messier?
Yeah, Elijah, I think the one thing for sure when Sidney Crosby came into the National Hockey League was, you know, the want to, the drive to be the best. I mean, when he stepped on the ice, you know, you saw video, you saw games, you saw him on tape, but once he stepped on the ice, you knew he wanted to be the best player, and he did not disappoint. I mean, just the inner drive, that's the one thing that I just respect the most of Sidney Crosby, is just his ability to want to be the best, you know, just a student of the game, you know, very soft-spoken. But, you know, when he came into Pittsburgh, I mean, he had a lot of pressure there. I mean, to save the franchise and, you know, to help bring the Stanley Cup back to Pittsburgh. And he was able to do that not once, not twice, but three different times. So not only a winner, but just a guy that makes other people around him better. And there's no doubt that, look, I was lucky enough to play with some of the greatest players in the NHL over my career, whether it was, you know, Mario Lemieux or Dennis Savard or Ronnie Francis, Timo Solani, Börje Salming, a former great Toronto Maple Leaf. I could go on and on. When I think of those guys and kind of how they're all intertwined, Sidney Crosby could play in any era just because of the intelligence and the work ethic. And obviously, you know, ultimately, you know, being a guy that could do it not only individually, but team-wise as well. So a real thrill, and had very little to do with the success that Sid has had in the National Hockey League, even though very proud to say I was his first coach.
So Eddie, you played for a few different teams, but for me, it seems like every team you played for is just a unreal, you know, talent to play hockey. And talk to us a little about your experience playing and living in Toronto.
Yeah, that was quite interesting, because I went from my hometown, being drafted and playing for my hometown team, the Chicago Blackhawks, and that was the ultimate dream to get a chance to play for the Blackhawks. But, you know, then I was traded in to Toronto, and I didn't feel as much pressure playing in Toronto as I did in Chicago. I knew it was, you know, it was the mega hockey market, in my opinion, but I just didn't feel that same pressure. I felt like I had more pressure at home than I did playing in Toronto. And, you know, I went from being, you know, I had 20 and 29 goals respectively in Chicago my first couple of years. And my third year, I just didn't have I had the junior jinx. I didn't have the sophomore jinx. I had the junior jinx. I just didn't have a very good third year. So I ended up getting traded, which was pretty tough getting traded from my hometown team. But when I went to Toronto, I just kind of felt like, okay, I'm just going to go play. And, you know, I did, you know, I had a taste of Toronto, and it not only as a kid of playing tournaments there, but I also played junior B hockey in Stratford, Ontario, which is only a couple of hours west of Toronto, I believe. And so I kind of knew what the pressure was of playing in Toronto. And when I went up there, I was just like, you know what, I love the game, and I'm just going to go and play. And, you know, I had some of my best years of my career in Toronto. I mean, I scored 42 goals my very first year in Toronto, my fourth year in the league. And, you know, playing on a line there with Gary Lehman and Mark Osborne. And Gary Lehman was one of the, I think, only one of three Maple Leafs in history to ever score 50 goals for the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I was proud to say I was his center iceman when he was able to do it. And but I really enjoyed playing in Toronto. my oldest boys were both born there. My son Eddie and Tommy were both born at Scarborough Centenary Hospital. And, you know, it was just a great experience to play for another Original Six team. And it was just very, you know, it made a huge impact on me and in my career. And I still have lots of friends in Toronto. And hoping the Leafs at some point here down the road can end the wait and see a Stanley Cup back in Toronto, because certainly the fan base certainly deserves it and would love to see the reaction of Maple Leaf fans down the road.
Yeah, Toronto is one of those teams I always say that it's so hard to love those guys. Love that team. So hard. But we want to pass on our congratulations to your brother Rick for getting announced as the assistant GM for the Seattle Kraken. How excited should the hockey world be that there is now 32 teams, and especially for those that are listening that are in Seattle?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great. I mean, the ownership, the leadership of Ronnie Francis, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, a former teammate of mine and a mentor of mine. He's in charge of hockey operations. My brother Rick, who's been involved in the NHL for many, many years and worked with Ronnie in Carolina, and they did an amazing job. Contrary to what people think, the team that they have in Carolina right now has a lot to do with my brother and Ronnie Francis and the staff that he had there. But what a chance. I mean, what an opportunity to go to Seattle and to be able to put a NHL franchise, you know, in a market into the National Hockey League. And it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm excited about the rivalry that will develop between them and Vancouver and the teams in California. So very excited for them. And yeah, there's a little bit of pressure, you know. I mean, you're an expansion team, and oh, by the way, we want to see what Vegas did. We want you to do that. We want you to go to Stanley Cup Finals in your very first year in the NHL. But we all know that that is not an easy task. But they have incredible leadership, and really looking forward to seeing the Kraken take the ice in less than a year, which is really hard to believe that we're going to have a new team in the National Hockey League in about you know, 10 or 11 months.
Have you thought about getting back into that side of hockey, like coaching, GM, stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think about it. If my wife was on the call, I know what she would vote when it would come to the coaching aspect of it. But, you know, I've had some opportunities. I've met with a few teams over the course of the last year plus or so. And, you know, nothing's come to fruition, but it's been really honoring and humbling that teams have called and kind of get a lay of the land and, you know, just kind of talk and chat. So, I love what I do. I'm very much at peace at what I'm doing right now. And considering everything that's gone on with me personally here over the course of the last couple of years, things are good. And we'll never say never. But I'm very honored and humbled that teams would call and ask and kind of gauge on my interest and, you know, see specific roles or duties that might be available. But, you know, we'll wait and see. But enjoy the TV and the broadcasting, and hopefully get back to the NHL sooner than later.
So at one point, you're tied with Phil Kessel for the second longest point streak by an American-born player in the NHL at 18 games. It's obviously something, you know, coaches and agents will tell you, you know, don't think about it. Just go out there and play. But I was just wondering if you know, games 14, 15, 16, like, do you remember what was going through your head that, like, before the games, and how did you feel when you finally went pointless?
Yeah, the only thing that I knew is that I was approaching an all-time Toronto Maple Leaf record, which was held by Daryl Sittler at 18 games. That was more the story. It wasn't necessarily, you know, an American-born player in the NHL. It was just more the aspect of, you know, the Maple Leaf record. So, you know, yeah, there was pressure, but, you know, it's on and you want to keep it going. And, you know, anytime you can get into a conversation with Daryl Sittler, you know, one of the greatest Toronto Maple Leafs of all time, you know, you're doing something right. So to have gotten to 18 and tied Daryl Sittler and then eventually have my scoring streak snapped to the New York Islanders. And my good friend Glenn Healy was playing goal for the Islanders that night, and he was the one that stopped the streak. And eventually, Heels and I ended up playing together with the New York Rangers. a few years later and winning a Stanley Cup in 94. So there isn't a day that goes by that Glenn Healy doesn't remind me of stopping my streak, but certainly great, great company to be in there individually with the Leafs record shared with Daryl Sittler, which still holds to this day, 18 games, and then sharing it with Phil Kessel. And then eventually a guy by the name of Patrick Kane has blown by it a couple of times with 20 and 25 game scoring streaks respectively with the Chicago Blackhawks. So it was a fun time. Yeah, it was a little bit of pressure, but you don't go on many runs like that and you got to take advantage of it, but very proud to have been able to go 18. And I think I got stopped by the Islanders, as I mentioned. And then I think I went on another run where I think I had points in 9 of 10 games. So I never know how far that could have went, but very proud to have that record.
So Eddie, everyone knows that this is Hockey Fights Cancer Month. And I think as a collective society, we need to fight this every day, not just within a month. We're going to talk to your doctor, Mary Mulcahy, in just a few minutes. But I first wanted to start with you by asking, you were directly affected mm-hmm. by this dangerous disease. Take us back to when you found out and how.
Yeah, I was relatively a healthy guy. I was 50, turning 51. I did have a colonoscopy set up for November of that year of 2017. So I was probably a year late when I probably should have had a colonoscopy, but I woke up one day in late July and I couldn't go to the bathroom. I couldn't go number two. I mean, that's just the reality. And that was not normal for me. And I didn't say anything and I waited another day. So now I'm going on 2 days and I'm like, there's something wrong. So, I went to the drugstore and I bought some Metamucil. I tried to break it up. I tried to get myself to go to the bathroom and nothing happened. And the next thing you know, I got violently sick and I'm being rushed to the hospital and they're telling me I have a blockage in my colon. And next thing you know, Kwame, I'm having a 6-hour surgery, removing a tumor in my colon and they're going to send it out. And, all of a sudden, on August the 4th of 2017 at 7:07 PM, my phone rings and it was Dr. Scott Strong, who was my surgeon. And it was a Friday night and he just let me know that my tumor came back. The read came back and told me that I was had stage 3 colon cancer and recommending chemotherapy. And the best oncologist in the world is going to be reaching out. I'm going to get a chance to meet with Dr. Mary Mulcahy and she's going to take me through and we're going to go from there. So, look, when I got that call, the first thing I thought was, I knew I was sick, obviously, and I had the surgery and everything, but once you're told that you have cancer and you have stage 3, the first thing that came into my mind was, okay, well, how long do I have to live? And it was very emotional and I was very scared. And, I'm still scared, even though I'm a couple of years removed from being cancer free and still fighting this battle. I'm still scared. It's always going to be with Eddie Olczyk and our family. But, one day I woke up, I couldn't go to the bathroom. Next thing you know, I'm having a surgery and then meeting with Dr. Mulcahy and telling me I have 6 months to chemotherapy and we'll reassess at the end of the 6 months. And that's how I found out. And, cancer does not discriminate. I don't care who you are, where you live, what color your skin is, what religion you are, what sex you are. It does not discriminate. And in my goal and my wife's goal and everybody at Northwestern Hospital that helped me along the way, I had incredible support and incredible team, is the more people that know my story, if we can help one person either stay away from it, if we can help one person, get through it, or if we can help one person inspire somebody to fight, because there were times during my battle where it was tough. And without the support of my wife and my family and all my doctors, I couldn't have done it by myself. So pretty simple. I didn't know what the signs were. I was asked a bunch of questions after the fact and I didn't know how to answer them because I really wasn't aware. I didn't, we all think we're invincible as a society and human nature, but for me in my life. And the one thing that I did prove myself is I'm way tougher than I ever thought I was. And without the support of my team of doctors and my wife, I wouldn't be here talking to you. And I'm just very lucky to be on the right side of the grass.
Yeah. When you find out news like this, what is the most important first step having gone through it that you can pass on to everybody else?
Well, I think the ability to be able to know where you were, to know where you are, and then knowing where you're going. And for me, it was, like I said, I mean, having a surgery and then they're going to assess the tumor and then they're telling me I have cancer. And then, you know, meeting with Dr. Mulcahy here in office, and I'll never forget that. I'm looking forward to bringing her on here shortly, Kwame. And I'll never forget. I mean, the meeting my wife and I had with Dr. Mulcahy, and this is probably the one thing that's most vivid to me is it's probably a good thing my wife was with me for that initial meeting with Dr. Mulcahy, because I don't remember a lot that was said in that meeting for 47 minutes. We were in office for 47 minutes. I don't know how I remember we were in there for 47 minutes, but we did a lot of talking. My wife did a lot of question asking, and I'm looking, you know, probably I had the 1,000-yard stare in the office of Dr. Mulcahy, and being my oncologist and the lady that was going to guide me through my chemo and what have you. And I think she could tell that obviously I was worried, and I'm sure she can sense that, but she said, Eddie, I need you to look at me. And it just kind of brought me out of a trance. And I remember just looking at her and she just said to me and said, look, I am here to cure you, not treat you. Do you understand the difference? And that really resonated with me and reeled me back in, because my mind was drifting in so many directions. Like I was sitting there, how in the hell am I sitting in a doctor's office talking about cancer, and I'm the one that's fighting this battle? And that was really important for me to hear that from Dr. Mulcahy. And look, at the end of the day, you know, knowing what I know now, guys, you know, I'm glad I'm the one that got it. Knowing what I know now and what I went through, and anybody out there that has been touched by this disease, doesn't have to be colon cancer, but it would really, really be difficult for me to see somebody that is in my circle, and we all have one, to go through, you know, every part of that. And I was very lucky. I mean, I had an incredible team and was able to fight through it and be on the right side. And now our goal is to inspire people, and not only the people that are stricken by this disease, but also to recognize the incredible caretakers and caregivers out there that help people that are fighting this battle. And so I think at the end of the day, it's about somebody hearing my story and saying, look, I was scared. There were times I was ready to quit because the side effects of the chemo broke me down. And I needed my wife to give me the greatest inspirational speech I ever had. And when I was ready to quit, my wife said, look, you got to fight. You got to fight for me. You got to fight for our kids. You got to fight for all the people that love you. And, you know, I was able to put my hockey helmet back on and go one day at a time. And instead of trying to have the Cliff Notes version of 6 months of chemo, I just said, you know what, I'm going to go day to day. And I'm just going to worry about tomorrow. I'm not going to worry about 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years. I'm just going to get through now. And then when I go and get reassessed with Dr. Mulcahy in 6 months, then whatever she says will go, and we'll go from there. So I would just encourage people to make sure that they know where they were, where they are, and where they're trying to get to, and fight, because there's a lot to fight for.
So being told you're cancer-free was probably something, you know, you remember very vividly. What was the first couple of things that were going through your head when you found this news?
I'm actually only sitting probably about 8 or 9 feet when Dr. Mulcahy called me, and my wife was standing right next to me and said that she had gotten my scan back, and everything looked clean and clear. And I mean, it was a sense of relief. It was a sense of I did it. We did it. And to know that, hey, you know, I'm going to have to continue to fight and I'm going to have to continue to go through this battle. And, but it was really, I was relieved. I was probably more relieved for my inner circle than I was for myself, because your family goes through a lot as well. I mean, I talk about the support of my family, but I never saw my wife down. I never saw my wife weak when she was around me. You know, I'm sure she had her moments when she would let her guard down and she was worried and whatever, but I just think that I was just overly thrilled that my team and my family supported me all the way through, and I didn't let them down, because when you're diagnosed with cancer, you kind of feel like you become a burden on everybody, and that's the last thing you ever want to do, and you don't want to let people down and worry your kids. And you know, that was one of the hardest things to tell my kids when I was sick, because you saw the worry on their face. And but to hear that I was cancer free from Dr. Mulcahy was certainly one of the greatest phone calls I've ever received, and will be forever grateful for her love and support, because she guided me through some most difficult times, and I had an incredible team, and just very, very, very proud to have had that team with me all the way through.
That's awesome. And so, speaking of Dr. Mary Mulcahy, she is joining us right now, the greatest oncologist in the mind of Eddie Olczyk ever in the world. Thank you for joining us, doctor.
Thank you for having me. And thank you for continuing this important conversation. With everything going on these days, we don't want these things to get ignored.
Yeah, we don't want to get these things lost in the shuffle. My mother passed away from colon cancer, liver cancer, excuse me. My two uncles of mine passed away from colon cancer. So it's very important that we talk about this. But first, I would just like to say to you, thank you for your service. Thank you for your dedication to your practice. It takes a special person to fight hard to help save another person's life. So on behalf of the Soul on Ice team, we want to say, Dr. Mary Mulcahy, thank you so much for keeping Eddie with us in the hockey world a lot longer.
It takes a village.
It does. It definitely does. There are many forms of cancer, as we know. You're Eddie's oncologist. Explain to our audience the main focus of what you do.
So as an oncologist, we're generally the person who looks at the whole treatment plan. So as Eddie described, he presented urgently and had an urgent surgery. So that was the first step, to get the tumor out. And then as a medical oncologist, you look at all those things like staging and prognosis, and we try and figure out what do we need to do to give this person the longest and best quality of life that we can. And in Eddie's case, given the stage of it, the goal was to cure it. So we are primarily the people that give the chemotherapy. So that's what a lot of people know us as a medical oncologist. We do the chemotherapy and we do all the monitoring and the surveillance ongoing for years.
Colorectal cancer disproportionately affects the Black community. Could you speak more on the importance of prevention, especially when we're young?
Yeah, that's a great point. So, you know, as Eddie pointed out, cancer can affect everybody, but access to healthcare is not equal. And what probably the most important thing for people to do, the screening colonoscopy is very important for to look for polyps, eradicate the polyps, and then you don't get the cancer later. So what we found is colon cancer is affecting people at a younger and younger age. And right now, the incidence of colon cancer is decreasing in every age group except for those younger than 50. It's on the rise. We don't know why, but it is. And because of this, the guidelines for screening colonoscopy, in the past it was always recommended that people get a colonoscopy at the age of 50. And people weren't always compliant with that. You know, it's who wants colonoscopy? It doesn't sound like a very pleasant thing, but it can actually prevent cancer. Remove the polyps, you don't get the cancer. And now all of these, the big medical boards that make these recommendations have lowered that age to 45 because we're seeing cancer occur younger and younger. So that just happened over the last this year, up just a few weeks ago, the Gastroenterology Association got on board with that, and the American Cancer Society, and they're recommending a colonoscopy at the age of 45 or 10 years younger than any person in your family. So if somebody had polyps at the age of 45, then their family members should be getting colonoscopy at the age of 35. Mm-hmm. And that's recommended because we know that it takes about 10 years for a polyp to turn into a cancer. So you get rid of that polyp, you prevent that cancer. So then the other issue is getting access to this. Some people these days, especially, they're struggling with insurance. Hopefully that will get better in getting these sorts of tests covered. And lots of organizations, and at Northwestern, we do have a program to get people access to colonoscopy, even if they don't have the means to pay, because it's really important. It is the only screening test that can prevent a cancer later, not just find a cancer, but prevent it. And it's so important to get that access for everybody. We don't know why younger people are getting colon cancer. And some of the disparities that we see, some is access to care, but we don't know if that's all of it. There may be other reasons that we just don't know yet.
Hey, Dr. McKay, I want to ask you a question. I think it's important for all of us. And I remember getting asked these questions, just about, did you ever notice any blood in your stool or, just things like that? Like, are there anything that young people or just anybody in general, like, what are some of those maybe warning signs that I didn't notice that maybe would have prevented me from having the surgery that I did and having the tumor as big as it was and then eventually having to go through the chemo, besides the obvious of having a colonoscopy? Is there anything that is a warning sign for any age group or prior to getting to that stage of a recommended colonoscopy?
Yeah, it's hard because sometimes it can be as subtle as just some intermittent abdominal pain, some diarrhea, right, some constipation, and these things right. happen to lots of people for any number of reasons. But symptoms that are consistent, if somebody's had a change in their bowel habits or a change in the caliber of the stool or detects any blood in the stool, it shouldn't be ignored. You go to your physician, you tell them what's going on. If somebody's found to have anemia, then that indicates that they probably had long-standing blood loss. So it's mm-hmm. probably something real that's been going on for a while. Because ideally we want to find these things early. We want to find them when we could just take them out and be done with it. I would be very happy if I never had to give chemotherapy again. So some things like just any sort of bowel type changes, mm-hmm. weight loss that's unexplained, things like that. You should bring it to your doctor. And that's part of the problem with young people is that a lot of younger people, they're not plugged in with a regular primary care doctor that they're seeing. And when they do go to the doctor, oftentimes it gets dismissed. These things can be dismissed and people have to be their own advocates, which is why programs like this are so important.
Yeah. It's a great point is to be able to, I think you're sitting there and going and raising your hand and going, you know what? I don't feel good. Yeah. Right. Like to have the courage, regardless of where you are or whatever you may be doing in your life is, most of us know our body and to say, hey, you know what? It's okay. I need to ask a question. I need to ask a question. And the more people that hear this, and that's a great point by Dr. Mulcahy, guys, is that, hey, you know what? Look, we have to take notice of ourselves because if we don't, who's going to? I mean, that's the reality of it. And again, I can just speak for myself, at a lot of points in my life, I've thought I'm invincible. I think that's just human nature. And then all of a sudden when it hits you like a sack of hammers, it's almost like, oh my gosh, how did I miss this? Did I not say something? Cause I had prior to me becoming constipated and then having that emergency surgery. I mean, those are all those things. I think, breaking it down of Dr. Mulcahy of just saying, we need to know ourselves and to say, hey, it's okay. I don't care, man, woman, doesn't matter, boy, girl, you got to speak up. you have to speak up, because if we can detect it early enough when we talk to, you know, to colon cancer, you know, you're going to be much, you know, much further ahead than maybe somebody like myself, because, you know, Dr. Mulcahy, I mean, like my tumor and like how long would it take in my situation, just off of, you know, memory and just, you know, your experience, your incredible experience, like how long would that tumor have been growing before it was removed to where I had the blockage in my colon?
Yeah, that's, I get asked that a lot. And that's a question that's impossible to answer. Every okay, okay. can behave a little differently. Right. We do know just from old studies that were done in the lab that polyps converting into cancer takes 10 years. But once there is a cancer, a lot of these, each cancer can behave differently. So how okay. long does it take to get okay. to a certain size or to spread out to lymph nodes or beyond that is really right. hard to say.
Right.
So it is okay. really a way of knowing.
Okay.
So unfortunately, like Kwame, you know, I've been close with a lot of family and friends who have been affected by cancer. And one thing I just remember is my mom always saying that for people who are fighting cancer, it's very important to keep their energy and, you know, just their mood up and positive and uplifted. And Doc, I just wanted to ask if you think that this has an effect on one's ability to fight cancer.
Yeah, that's a great question. Sure. So I think people who maintain a regular exercise program, and I'm not talking about marathon training, just, you know, every day taking a walk around the block, just any kind of regular exercise, people who maintain a healthy diet, not going on any, a lot of people will just change their diets to something, and they shouldn't, just a well-balanced, healthy diet, regular exercise program. And I think something that can be really helpful is talking about it and having people that are listening. So a lot of people don't want to burden, you know, the person with cancer feels like they're a burden to their loved ones, and all their loved ones want to do something, but they don't know what to do. They don't know what they can do. They're just watching somebody go through this. So to really just have that open dialogue where you could just support each other, give people space to talk, and, you know, being good listeners and just kind of supporting people through this whole process. It definitely can make a difference. People who have a good support system around them, they can get through this a lot better.
Doc, what's your advice about prevention, you know, that a lot of people don't know? And how much does your family's medical background history play into what you need to be doing to stay on top of your health?
Yeah. So if you're talking health in general, it is important. So knowing your family history, and a lot of people don't know their family history until they get a disease. Then they start asking the questions. Mm-hmm. So understanding, you know, how old people, your relatives, your immediate relatives, and then the next generation, how long did people live? What illnesses did they have during their life? It can help to identify syndromes that could potentially be inherited. So we're finding more and more of these things, more genes that can be passed on. Most colon cancers, and specifically colon cancers, are not inherited. Most of them, we don't have a gene that we can identify that has been passed on through the family. But some people just, they have this in their family and we haven't identified a gene. And the problem is we just don't know it yet.
Right.
You know, we don't know all the genes that cause cancer yet. So understanding the family history and letting your doctors know this is how old people were when they had an illness and how many people you have in your family. If you have 10 kids and one person had cancer, it's probably not an inherited syndrome. But if there's 10 kids and five of them have cancer, then there's your chance that it's an inherited syndrome. So things like knowing the family history, and then it's really just living a healthy lifestyle. There's nothing, cancer is indiscriminate. So, you could be a world-class athlete. You could be, you know, the Black Panther. You can be a Supreme Court justice, and it can affect anybody. And it's really what kind of shape you're in going into it that you're going to be able to get through it.
I'm 21, Akil's 20, Kwame's 50. Is there an age that's too young or too old to go get yourself checked?
No. So, Jen, right now, the screen, if you have no family history, if nobody in your family has had colon polyps or a colon cancer. Or if they did, but they were in their 60s or 70s, that's probably not inherited. Probably not. So the recommendation right now is 45. At the age of 45, for your first screening colonoscopy. And screening colonoscopy means you have no symptoms. You are a perfectly normal, healthy person, and they are just going to look for something in a healthy person.
I have done that, by the way, everyone.
Good man. If you have any symptoms, then it's no longer screening colonoscopy. Now you're looking for a cause for your symptoms. So at any age, if you're having any sort of symptoms, then you go get checked out. But if you have no symptoms and you have no significant family history, the age of 45 is when it's recommended. If somebody in your family had colon cancer at the age of 50, then you should get checked out at the age of 40. We're looking for the polyps that can prevent the cancer. And it works. It worked in our population of people in their 60s. The average age for colon cancer remains in their 60s. Get the colonoscopy at 50, take the polyps out. We're seeing a decrease in those cancers in their 60s.
So as of now, there's no cure to all cancers. But it seems like through time, society just seems to figure out how to do the impossible, come out with new technologies and all of that. How many new treatments or findings about cancer are being discovered these days?
Yeah, cancer has changed. I've been doing this for 20 years now. And when I started, we had one drug to treat colon cancer. And we now have about 8, maybe more. And we're identifying different populations and how to treat them specifically. Not all colon cancers are the same. So we're identifying some cancers that may respond to these new immunotherapy drugs that you may hear about. You see commercials about them. They only work in a certain population of in particular cancers. We're finding very specific drugs that we wouldn't have used otherwise that may work in particular types of cancers. So it's changed dramatically. We're curing things that we never thought we would be able to cure back when I started. So progress is being made. It's always too slow, but we are making significant progress. It's encouraging. That's what kept me in it. You know, that's what, when I first started doing this, as I said, there was one drug. And as I was in my training, I was working with a doc who was involved in all these clinical trials, and we were studying new drugs, and I was treating patients with these and seeing them live longer. And it really just was inspiring to see that we can make this progress and we could just see it in real time. And that's continued. And it's even broken into a whole other area with these new immunotherapy drugs. So it's an exciting time. We're getting there. All cancers are not the same. They're not all going to be treated the same, but we're learning more and more about them.
Eddie, before we let Dr. Mulcahy go, do you have anything else you'd like to talk to her about?
Well, I mean, I've told her this in private, but just not only the team working under her, but they helped me get through my most difficult time. And the relationship that you develop with your doctor when you're going through a battle is something that is very special. And I'll be forever grateful to you, Dr. Mulcahy, for helping me through and helping my family through our most difficult time. So I love you and I love your team and Miss Marcia and Miss Caroline and everybody that saw me every 2 weeks at Northwestern. And there isn't a day that doesn't go by that I don't think about where we all have been. And if it wasn't for you, I know I wouldn't be here. So I thank you from the bottom of my heart and thank you for being a part of our battle with Hockey Fights Cancer. And I hope one day down the road, it's hockey beats cancer. Mm. And we'll have you back on and chat about where we were, where we are, and where we're trying to get to. So thank you so much for all you do for all of us. And we really appreciate your time today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. I appreciate you all doing this because it you need to get out. You need to get the message out. And people don't want to talk about colon cancer, yeah. You know? And so you just need to talk about it and not use euphemisms and just get out there and get people to pay attention.
Dr. Mary Mulcahy, this is my first time meeting you. And I can just tell just by your energy and your presence that you are sent here from the heavens above doing great work. Is there anything that you can share before we let you go to our audience as far as you know, maybe research that they can do on their own, or something specific they can do right now to make sure that they are in the right direction, or, you know, any information about what you're doing that we can share that people can pay attention to?
Well, I think the most important thing is for people to get screened, and that colonoscopy screening is the most important thing at the age of 45. As of right now, we'll get covered by insurance. It's all approved. That's when it should be done, at the age of 45. People should have a screening colonoscopy. You can know your family history, talk to your family. Thanksgiving's coming and we're all doing this remotely, but you know, find out about any family history that might be going on, and just, you know, get the word out, share this information with other people, because it really is word of mouth to tell people how important it is. Hand out Eddie's book, say, look, this is what we're talking about. Cause it's very, it beautifully just describes just what it's like to go through this.
Dr. Mary Mulcahy, thank you for joining us. We're going to keep Eddie for a little bit longer, but again, but on the behalf of the crew, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
See you, Doc.
Thank you.
For having Happy me. Thanksgiving. Thanks.
Happy Thanksgiving to y'all.
Eddie, back to you. This past year, we saw Oscar Lindblom diagnosed with Ewing's sarcoma, a rare form of bone cancer. It was said that he was likely going to be done for the season, but we were fortunate enough to get to see him return back. What were your thoughts on that? And have you ever had the chance to talk to him or any other hockey player with cancer?
Yeah, I mean, communicated quite a bit with Oscar, and just an inspiring story. I mean, really, it was just amazing to have him back and to know what he fought through. And, you know, it's an emotional time. You know, I mean, anytime I see Dr. Mulcahy, he, you know, takes me back to a real low point in my life. But if she wasn't a part of it, I wouldn't be here today, as I said a little bit earlier. But I mean, how can you not be inspired by a guy like Oscar Lindblom of the Philadelphia Flyers? I mean, just to be able to battle like he did, to fight like he did, to be an inspiration to so many people. And I think that's the biggest key, Elijah, is you, when you are the person that is sick, you have that ability to inspire people around you, people that you don't know, people that may be sick, have been sick. It's an incredible feeling of power to know that you can do some good, even though you may be at your very lowest. And to me, that was as much of a highlight of any in both bubbles when you saw Oscar take the ice and play for the Flyers, and the respect that was shown on the ice. And it was just an amazing time. And just wishing him the very best. And like I said, we're all day to day in the big picture, and hopefully he's feeling good. And I know he's doing a lot of good off the ice as well.
Speaking of doing a lot of good off the ice, you wrote a book called Beating the Odds. When did you decide to write the book, and can you kind of give us a breakdown about what the book's all about?
Yeah, it was, I'd been approached by Perry Lefko, who's an award-winning author and is a hockey and horse racing guy up there in Toronto. And I got to know him when I played for the Leafs in the late 80s. And, you know, Perry had approached me after I had retired and, you know, asked me if I'd be interested in writing a book. And I was like, I got some good stories, and there's probably a lot of good stories I'd like to tell that I can't tell, just because I don't want to sell anybody down the river. But I guess I could have used, fake names or whatever. But, you know, I just thought, you know, there was really nothing there. And then, you know, I decided maybe we'd do it. And then just we kind of got halfway through, and then I kind of got cold feet. And we paused it for a couple of years. And then next thing you know, I was going through my battle with cancer. And I'm like, you know, no pun intended, you know, this might be the final chapter, the reason and decision why I'm going to go ahead and write the book. And with me getting sick, I thought I had a chance to really tell a story to where I came from, to what I, was able to accomplish in my career, both professionally and personally, and then eventually my battle with cancer. So it's a wide range of hockey and horse racing and my battle with cancer and my family and you know, the obstacles that I had to overcome in my life and in my career, and very proud of it. And some of my former friends, I say former because of the cheap shots that they take, they all asked if there are they're all crayons with this book. No, there are no crayons with this book. This is a straight reading book. It's not a coloring book or anything like that. So I'm very proud of it. It's done very well. And, you know, somebody asked me, are you going to, write another book? I'm like, nah, I think I spilled my guts enough. One book enough for Medi Olchek. And I'm sure there are a few of my teachers back in the day are probably rolling their eyes wondering, like, is this the same Medi Olchek that came to class every day? There's no way this guy could have written a book, but, I'm very proud of it. And my family was a big part of it. And my family's a big part of my life. And hopefully I can inspire one person. And that's the reason, guys, that I did it, is maybe I can inspire one person. And at the end of the day, if I do that, if I can help one person, then it was well worth the, you know, the 10 months of pen to paper.
So about 2 years ago, you suited up with the Chicago Blackhawks for, you know, quote unquote, one more shift. Talk to us a little bit about that experience.
Wow. To be honored and recognized by the Blackhawks. I mean, just a great tradition that they started to bring back the past, to tie in the current player, and to go out there and, get a chance to skate around and, be recognized by the fan base. And, you know, I think that's really important. I think it's important to tie the past players with the current players in all sports. I mean, I'm a big believer of that. I was somebody when I was growing up, I mean, I knew who all the old guys were. Hey, Kwame, the OGs, right? That's, I mean, right. I knew who all the OGs were. I did. That was my life. And I don't think it's as much today as it was maybe back in my day. I mean, look, to be able to get that information now is easy.
Easy.
I mean, for me back in the day, I mean, you had to thumb through books and you had to, you know, the hockey news, and, you know, it wasn't online and it wasn't somebody sending you text or on Twitter or Space Face or whatever the hell you guys call it. I mean, you know, like you had to do some work. You had to, you know, look up on it. And, so I think just being recognized by the Blackhawks, who I obviously, you know, I'm still a big part of. I do their games locally on television besides working for NBC nationally here in the States. And but to go out there and it was just a wonderful night, and to put on that sweater again. Yeah, there was probably a piece of me that thought, you know, maybe I could take a shift now or take a face off or stand in front of the net on a power play. Actually, Brent Seabrook, the terrific defenseman for the Blackhawks, was out on the ice and asked me if I wanted to take a shift. And I'm like, maybe one. That's all I got. Maybe one. I'd be one and done and what have you. But that was a great night, one more shift. And they've done it with a lot of great Blackhawks. And I think it's a great way to honor the past and reconnect with the new fan base. And I think it's just an incredible job that the Blackhawks, led by Rocky Wirtz and Danny Wirtz, to be able to have something like that. And I'm thrilled that I was a part of it.
To know where we're going in the future, you got to know the past. You know, we have a very young listenership, young men that are listening right now. What are some of the things you need them to understand when it comes to taking care of their bodies, mm-hmm. That you yourself weren't really thinking about at your younger age?
Yeah. I mean, look at, I'll just tell you guys, I mean, it's well documented. I mean, I chose to live my life a certain way. I never drank, I never smoked, never did drugs. I have some people tell me, well, what'd you do for fun? I mean, I'm like, well, you know, like, I like to play the horses. I mean, I'm a gambler by heart, and that was kind of my release. But you know, I just chose to live my life a certain way. It didn't make me any bigger, any better, any stronger, any tougher, any, you know, whatever. That was just Medi Olchek. And if somebody didn't like me for who I was or who I am, that's your problem. That's not my problem. You know, peer pressure is such an important part of a young person's life. I played in the NHL when I was 18. I had lots of peer pressure to drink with the guys and to go to happy hour and hang out and whatever. But I just chose not to do it. And, you know, I think you need to be your own person, regardless if it's, you know, talking about a religious belief or, you know, something that you stand for, somebody that you stand with, something that you see a certain way, you have to have conviction. And for me, I'm just using that as an example, where I had plenty of opportunity. I mean, look at, I was like a young, any hot young hockey player, you leave home when you're 15 or 16. I left home when I was 15 or 16 and could easily, you know, done whatever I wanted to do and not have to answer to anybody. But I just chose to live my life a certain way. And still to this day, I still don't drink and, you know, I don't do, you know, I mean, I have a great life. I'm not bored. I don't think I'm boring. But sometimes I think people get put into situations that they're not prepared for. And peer pressure is such an important part of growing up and maturation is like, look at you, you got to have conviction. You have to have beliefs. And as I said a little bit earlier, you know, it's the mindset of knowing where you were, where you are, and where you're trying to get to. You could still have fun. You could, you know, look at, you want to partake in those type of things. I mean, hey, that's your life. You know, I'm not here to dictate or talk to anybody any certain way, but if you have a belief or a conviction that you feel strongly about, stick to it. You know, don't succumb to the peer pressure because look, at the end of the day, I mean, you know, we're all day to day, as I said a little bit earlier, and you know, we're not invincible, and you know, just want everybody to understand is that to accept people for who they are and where they come from and what their beliefs may be, and hey, you know what? Just go about doing what you want to do. That's kind of how I've always lived my life, and. But that's the one thing when I do talk to kids at schools and have an opportunity, you know, when we're not social distancing, is to talk about peer pressure and people always, kids always ask me, well, you know, how do you say no, you know, because then you have people making fun of you and calling you names and now with social media and all, I mean, I get it. I understand it, but you gotta have that conviction. You gotta draw a line in the sand and say, look at, I'm choosing not to do this. And if you don't like me for who and what I, and for who I am, for what I stand for, then you're not my friend.
Yeah.
And you know, look at, you can't control what people say. The only thing you can control is what you do. And I would hope that regardless of your beliefs or where you live or you know, you like hockey, you don't like hockey. That's the real world. And there's only certain things that we can control as individuals in society. And that's what I've kind of tried to do my whole life. And, you know, so far, so good, as far as I'm concerned.
In 2019, as we all know, you were named Hockey Fights Cancer Ambassador. What is your personal mission? What do you want to do with that title as you wear it?
Well, I mean, I'm proud that that the league would ask me to be the ambassador and to represent this incredible initiative since 1998. It's probably, in my opinion, the greatest initiative National Hockey League has taken hold of, you know, with all their great endeavors off the ice. But, you know, I would want people to know my story. And I appreciate you guys having me on and being able to share my story. And if I could just help one person, I really believe that. I'd like to think I've helped more than one person. But if I can help that one person and that one person helps one person, then all of a sudden now you look at the numbers and then it becomes a tidal wave. And like I said, if it's just inspiring them to get through the day or inspiring them to go get a colonoscopy, inspiring them to be a caretaker or caregiver, you know, to look at things maybe a little bit differently. That's my goal. And, I just couldn't be more proud to have been the ambassador and now doing some stuff, obviously with no NHL season right now during Hockey Fights Cancer and helping out with the league. I'm just very proud of that and, we'll continue to fight and, fight for the person that I know, fight for the person that I don't know. And as we said a little bit earlier, hopefully, you know, at some point in our lifetime, instead of hockey fights cancer and hockey beats cancer. And I sure hope I'm around when that takes place.
Based on some data from 2015 to 2017, approximately 39.5% of men and women will be diagnosed with cancer at some point during their life. Did you have any awareness of the amount of people that are diagnosed with cancer?
It's a sobering, staggering number when you really think about it. And as I've learned, and I try to say, is that it does not discriminate. It doesn't matter where you are, what sex you are, what color you are, where you live, your age, it doesn't. And this month, when in a normal hockey season, and a lot of junior teams and colleges and sports teams, when they do have their cancer battles, or their cancer awareness days or months or what have you, their initiatives, they hold up those placards. Our hockey fights cancer, I fight for placards, it's fighting for us.
Yeah.
It's fighting for society. It's fighting for all of us, because there's a pretty good chance with those numbers Elijah just gave, are staggering, and we're pretty much all going to be affected by it in some form or fashion, sadly, in our lifetime. But with the help of incredible doctors like Dr. Mulcahy and her team and all those great first responders and men and women are around North America, they're fighting every day and helping people get through it. So, all we can do is keep going day to day and then hopefully be on the right side of this as a society sooner than later.
Just so everyone knows, to this date, there's a lot of groups that have been supporting the NHL along with their fans. They've donated more than $28 million to support the national and local cancer research institutions, children's hospitals, players, charities, and local charities. What would you advise is the best way that people can also support or contribute?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think obviously, I mean, look, in the world that we're living in, I mean, we haven't touched on it. I mean, it's out there and we know that. I mean, we're living during a global pandemic, and it's hard for, it's hard for fundraising. It's hard to not have that hesitancy to go and be a volunteer to certain places of need. And I think that anything that you can do as a citizen that is looking to help somebody is to, hey, pick up the phone, send a text, send an email. If you know somebody that's in a battle, don't be afraid to let them know you're thinking about them. Perfect example is a guy by the name of Tom Curvers. Tommy Curvers, the assistant general manager with the Minnesota Wild, is in a battle. He has a form of stomach cancer, and he's been in a battle here for the last, I guess it's almost going on 8 to 10 months here. And a former teammate of mine with the Toronto Maple Leafs back in the day. And TK, we're praying for you, man. We love you. And we know you're going to keep battling, but I think it's just, of reaching out. And I think sometimes, and I've heard the stories because I lived it. I mean, I had people that I thought I would hear from when I was sick.
Yeah.
They never reached out to me, and having communicated with them after, they all said, geez, I didn't know what to say. I didn't want to bother you or whatever. Well, there's something to not knowing what to say. I understand that, but we want to hear from you. We need your support. So I would encourage anybody out there just to pick up the phone or send an email or a text and let somebody know that, hey, you know what? I'm thinking about you. And, if you need anything, I think that is as much, I think that is as important as anything else, is that connection, that human reach that we all have the ability to. This doesn't have to be just cancer. I mean, it could just be somebody that's going through a difficult time in their life to just say, hey, man, I'm thinking about you, right? Keep your head up. If you ever want to talk or whatever, I'm here for you. Because even during this pandemic we're all living through, I mean, people are battling, not only trying to stay away from this pandemic and the virus, but also too, the mental challenge we're all going through is, hey, we need to make sure that we're reaching out to everybody, anybody that we have a connection with, anybody that is in our circle, guys, we need to reach out to them, whether they're older, whether they're younger, doesn't matter. Everybody needs somebody to look out for them. And even if it's just a quick call, I think that's very important. But we're going to get on the right side of this pandemic. I know we are.
Yeah.
We're going to get back to, you know, whatever the so-called new normal is going to be. But we're going to be able to continue to fight this battle against cancer. And like I said, I can't wait till hockey beats cancer, and I'll be the first one in line is when we're celebrating that. That's for sure.
I hear you.
Just to kind of add on to what both you guys said, I just want to point out that thanks to investments in prevention, early detection, and treatment, the overall five-year cancer survival has increased from about 25% in the 1940s to 63% today. And survival for childhood breast and prostate cancers are higher at 84%, 88%, and 93% respectively. So it's a lot to be optimistic about.
Yeah, we've come a long way, Elijah. We've come, look at it, in all walks, right? Like, look at that's just over time, right? Learning more people in case studies, understanding exactly that, how it affects, what treatments are helping certain people. They have all this documented. I mean, just think about society. And again, you guys, a lot younger than the guy that's talking right now, but I mean, the world has changed a lot here in the last 10 years, let alone the last 25 or 30 years, to be able to document a lot of these cases and help people along the way. So, I mean, there's lots to feel good about, but also a lot of work to be done. And when you see the leadership like we had with Dr. Mulcahy a little bit earlier, it really inspires you. And you have to be a very, very, and she is, and her team, you're a very unique individual, very special person to be able to deal and be able to handle what they are doing on a daily basis. I mean, they see, sadly, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people every week. I'm just one of her patients. We're in a much better spot than we were. But we got a lot of work to do, and it's really been great being on with you guys today. And I look forward to meeting you all soon in person, face to face, hopefully maskless down the road here. But it's been a great day to be with you guys, and really appreciate you guys allowing me the platform to tell my story and to talk about Hockey Fights Cancer. And we're all in this thing together. We're all on the same team. Regardless of where we're sitting or what we're doing, very proud to be on this team with you guys, and really appreciate you guys allowing me the opportunity to chat with you all.
Maybe you'll get to call one of Akil's games when he gets out there in LA, and get to maybe chirp him on the air a little bit. I don't know, do something fun. But
all in good nature, Akil. All in good nature, pal.
Thank you.
Listen, Eddie, we just lost connection with Elijah, but I know he wanted to say thank you for being here with us. Eddie, you are a warrior. You're a fighter. You're, like I said at the top of the show, you're one of the OGs, and we appreciate you. We got mad love for you, and we are glad you are still here with us, and we're glad you came on to rock with the boys, and this has been great, man. Thank you so much for your time.
All right. God bless you guys. Thanks for fitting me in your schedule. You guys all stay safe, and hopefully, like I said, we'll get a chance to shake hands and meet in person somewhere down the road, and I wish you guys all the best and look forward to next time coming on, maybe talking a little pucks and ponies somewhere down the road
We do. We got to talk pucks. But you know what? I think we're not going to let you off the hook on this one, though. We have to get your top five, man. We got to get, I don't care if it's one or two songs. Okay, I need to know a couple of songs that Eddie loves.
Okay. All right. Well, the first song would be is by Roberta Flack.
Oh, here we go.
The first time I ever saw your face, and that beautiful. Was my wife's and I a wedding song back in we got married in 1998. No, that's
you
well
in trouble
after.
Now, bro. Yeah, you're in trouble.
I
know, if she listens.
I can't even think.
You better just walk. Away.
How about 1988? How's that? 88. That sounds good, right? 88 good. Sounds good. So yeah, Roberta Flack, and then the other one would be and I'll tell the story really quick. It's Kenny Loggins. Okay. And the name of the song is "This Is It."
Of course.
So when I was a midget player playing for Team Illinois, we were playing in a midget national championship in Manchester, New Hampshire in 1982. And we were playing a team, we were playing CompuWare. And on that team, they happened to have Pat LaFontaine, Ally Afraidy. I mean, mm-hmm. they were pretty stoked. And they played, they were the best midget team ever. That's what they said. They were the best midget team ever assembled. So we were playing them in the midget national championships. And our head coach, Tim Mueller, still a very close friend of mine, he brought in a big boom box right before the game. And he put in a cassette tape because there were no DVDs or any, you know, DVRs or anything like that. No iPods or pads.
No aux.
And that nothing. And all he put in was the song, This Is It. Mm. And when you listen to the words,
yes,
it can hit home in a lot of different areas, whether personally, professionally, spiritually, or trying to win a national championship in USA Hockey. And I'll be honest with you, there was not, and look at, you're a midget player. I was a midget. I was 15 or 16 years old. Every single guy in the room was crying before we were going out on the ice. And every day I hear that song, it makes me think of that. And oh, by the way, it ended right because we beat CompuWare 4-2 to win the national championship in 1982. So This Is It certainly was it. Back in 82.
I love it. Now my two youngins over here, they don't know those artists, but hopefully they're going to listen. We have a Spotify Soul on Ice music list, so we're going to put those on there for everybody else to go and check out. I know that song. This Is It is a great song. I mean, you know, when you hear Kenny Loggins the first time, you're going to think he's a black guy singing. You know, you don't know that it's a white guy singing. You're going to hear that and be like, yo, that brother's got some soul. And then when you see a picture, he's like, who's that? That's Kenny Loggins? Okay, gotcha. I gotcha. I'm playing. All right. But that's a great couple of songs, man. And
I appreciate it, guys. God bless you all. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Eddie Olczyk holding it down with the boys on Soul and Ice, the podcast. You know, this is our Hockey Fights Cancer episode. And, you know, it's so hard to find people who do not have anybody that has been affected by cancer. It's one of the craziest diseases out there. And I thought that this episode was great. And you guys did a great job contributing and asking some great questions. Big shout out to Dr. Mary Mulcahy as well for joining us.
Yeah, for sure. I thought it was a pretty, you know, inspiring story. Obviously, Eddie had a sick career, and you know, it's a big name, and for him to, you know, overcome all that is awesome. And, you know, Kwame, like you said, cancer is you know, a very, you know, scary thing. Doesn't discriminate. In some cases, you know, it's not preventable and stuff. So definitely, you know, love the initiative of, you know, Hockey Fights Cancer, and hopefully we can keep pushing, and, you know, as a society, you know, find more treatments, more cures, and really get rid of cancer altogether.
And yeah, I just want to take a second to kind of remember all the people that we've lost from cancer this year. Dale Hawerchuk, Akil and I played against his teams many times. In the past, like you said, Kwame, I'm pretty sure everyone knows someone who's passed from cancer. My Aunt Rose, rest in peace to her. And just anybody else who has lost someone from cancer or has got someone that they know that's going through cancer, just, you know, we're here to support. There's a lot of people that are out there to support, and, you know, for them to just stay strong.
Yes. All right, boys. We are going to be Audi 5000. Thank you for joining us. Make sure you check us out on all social media platforms. We've even got a Spotify playlist, as well as a Reddit thread. So make sure you check that out. And of course, we've got to let you guys know about our promotion going on with manscaped.com. Promo code SOUL. Get 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. We are hooking up a really cool, perfect package 3.0. It could be yours. All you got to do is go to manscaped.com. Use the promo code SOUL. My name is Kwame. Those are my nephews, Akil Thomas and Elijah Roberts. Thank you for joining us. We out. Bong, bong.
And when we make it, we gon' put our soul on ice. Cause when they doubted us, we did it twice. I guess the poop is in the freezer. They tried to get rid of us, but they need us. So I need you, like you need me. I need you, like you need me. We double up when our numbers come through the TV. Yeah. Soul on ice, I'ma put my soul on ice. Nice. You goddamn right, I'm screaming on that beat. I got a match screaming on the streets. We in the club, stadium, and the arena, cousin. Put me on ice and I'm hitting that top. Cheese a dozen, fussing, fighting with myself is enticing. My enemies in the mirror, and he's always reciting the poetry of my power, statistic of my weakness. Shadow boxing with Tyson, I'm trying to show y'all I'm beating them to the punch. Competition on the table, which time for lunch? Though my mission is unstable, I'm scoring once, twice, three times, and I'm taking hats. Men lie, women lie, progress is based upon the facts. So let that baby shine, they solar show and older. They live within the grind, now take them out that stroller. Cause coming up is a champ, prediction of Ali. He changed his name to Muhammad, we changing free to a fee. It's up to me, and when we make it, we gon' put our soul on ice. Cause when they doubted us, we did it twice. I guess the poop is in the freezer. They tried to get rid of us, but they need us. So I need you, like you need me. I need you, like you need me. We double up when our numbers come through the TV. Soul on ice, I'ma put my soul on ice. Nice. Let's dedicate this one to Jade and Linda. Let's escalate to Caddy, crush the Pinto. Or maybe you prefer that Benz, why? That big truck, I don't give a f**k, only really want a house for the get by. Let's take it far down on the competition. Competition is nonsense, it's me and my soul's decision. Yeah, I only work against myself. I play against you to bench you. I'm throwing all shots to the shelf. Yeah, the top is the topic. You checking your armor. My wheel telescopic, so I'm steering my karma. The future is mine, like receiving the past. From Jesus to Jordan to Crosby, Stills and Nash. We young, and when we make it, we gon' put our soul on ice. Cause when they doubted us, we did it twice. I guess the proof is in the freezer. They tried to get rid of us, but they need us. So I need you, like you need me. I need you, like you need me. We double up when our numbers come through the TV. Soul on ice, I'ma put my soul on ice. Nice.